Good afternoon, and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson. I'm the director of the Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, and it's brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. And don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page on the KHSU website at khsu.org. Today, my guest is Alderon Laird. We're going to be talking about sea level rise and its implications for Humboldt Bay. This is a part of a project that Alderon has been engaged in. Alderon, maybe you could start by giving us just a brief introduction, who you are, what your experience is, these issues, and why you came to this subject.
I've been up here on the North Coast since 1975. Went to school at HSU. And since 1978, I've been involved with salmon recovery projects for over 35 years now, I guess. And for the last 20 years, I've specialized in getting permits for people that do habitat enhancement projects on California rivers and California tidal waters like lagoons and Humboldt Bay. Besides specializing in permits and regulatory constraint, one of the other areas I specialize in is doing historical research for public trust doctrine purposes, as well as sovereign lands delineations. And in 2007, I prepared a historical atlas of Humboldt Bay and the Eel River Delta. And so going through that project, I got to see what the shoreline looked like at the first contact with Europeans starting in 1806 and see how the shoreline has changed over the last 150 plus years due to our land use activities, and came to realize that we really don't have a current inventory or mapping of what's out there on the shoreline. And then when Governor California issued an executive order to develop sea level rise or climate change adaptation strategies, one of the things that was identified for sea level rise was coming up with baseline or existing conditions of the shoreline. And the Coastal Conservancy started a planning grant program for climate change, and I applied for a grant to inventory and map Humboldt Bay so we could create 2010 baseline conditions, and from that be able to assess the impacts that sea level rise might have on that shoreline and the land uses behind the shoreline. So that's how I got into this project. So I just completed all the field work just the beginning of the year, and we're doing the second phase of the GIS mapping, and we hope to be complete with the entire project this month in May.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention the great article that Heidi Walters wrote this project in the North Coast Journal a couple months back. I'm sure you can find that on the North Coast Journal website. But I was actually inspired to ask you on the program by seeing you deliver a brief PowerPoint presentation at the Humboldt Bay Symposium last week. Maybe we should just say a little bit about the symposium and what that's about, and how the sea level rise issue came to be front and center for the symposium.
Well, the symposium happens every 2 years, so the last one was 2010. So this year, since 2010 and now, an awful lot has happened regarding climate change, particularly sea level rise and developing adaptation strategies or how to mitigate for that. And since I've been doing this project for the last year and a half, I got involved with the Humboldt Bay Harbor District and Dan Berman, their conservation director, and suggested that we make sea level rise, you know, the focal point of the conference this year. So the first plenary session was devoted to sea level rise, and we had an introductory presentation by Jerry Rohde showing the historical changes that have occurred, and an introduction to Humboldt Bay, or Ouija, as Cheryl Sider calls the bay based on the Wiat language. And so I think we got the full breadth from the global perspective all the way down to the regional Humboldt perspective, and then into even the project level adaptation, what the city of Arquette is doing on McDaniel Slough, and also heard some of the cutting edge research that's being done by the vertical reference group, GeoCascadia, Tom Leroy. I made that presentation. And so there's a lot going on. It's almost a bit overwhelming trying to stay on top of all the literature and studies and projects that are going, not only just in Humboldt Bay, but in California particularly.
But my understanding is that if folks are interested in the presentations that were made at the Humboldt Bay Symposium and didn't get a chance to see them live in person, they'll be available on the Harbor District's website, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that's true. They were videoed, so yeah, they should be made available to people shortly, I think. And there were some great presentations.
If you're just joining us, this is the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, director of Friends of the Eel River. Today I'm talking with Alderon Laird about his project to inventory and assess the potential for sea level rise impacts around Humboldt Bay particularly. So let's talk a little bit about how you did the project. You said, Alderon, that you'd already created a historical atlas that told us something about where we think the shoreline was at European contact. But you said we didn't really know what the actual circumstances of the bay's edge basically are now. So how did you?
Well, you see, if you go online, there's a lot of inundation maps or flood maps that you can go to, and you can click on various elevations, you know, floods of, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 meters, and it'll show you the area that's inundated. And if you look usually generally at the bottom of those maps, they have a disclaimer saying that this is shoreline conditions would completely alter the area that may be inundated by rising sea level rise, because if there's dikes there to prevent the tidewater from coming in, even though the ground behind the dike is low in elevation, it's not being inundated. So those kind of inundation maps really, in some instances, overplay how much is being flooded. You really need to know what the shoreline is made up of so that you can determine, you know, during those extreme high tide events and when we have surges, that's when we're going to have failures on the shoreline. So we need to know what kind of structures are on the shoreline, where are there openings or gaps or breaches, which parts of the shoreline may be eroding, it's the to failure, or what part of the shorelines are too low in elevation that they're overtopped by these extreme high tides, and then certainly under various sea level scenarios, they would be overtopped. So by looking at the actual on-the-ground conditions, we could see the entry points for these high tides or floods that would then inundate some of the areas behind the structure. It's not just a straight two-dimensional, what's the elevation of the surrounding area, and it automatically is going to be flooded. That doesn't take into account existing conditions. So that was the reason why I proposed this project, was to establish baseline conditions so that other people could develop models for inundation. We could also develop various mitigation scenarios for land use planning based on the conditions of the shoreline. And the reason, you know, I think that this is important is that this isn't really theoretical. We've already had major breaches on the shoreline of Humboldt Bay. In 2003, there was a major breach around Christmas on Mad River Slough, and it flooded, you know, a couple of 100 acres of organic pasture, and it stayed flooded for quite a long time. They had to put a water coffer dam in, and they probably would not have got the money to repair that dike. It had never been maintained. It was totally overgrown. You couldn't drive a vehicle on it. If it wasn't for actually Katrina and the flood events of that, and FEMA coming up with levee repair money, and the Reclamation District and Arcata Bay applied for some money to rebuild the dikes because they had no money. They were essentially a bankrupt organization, and they ended up getting $11 million. To rebuild and fortify about 5 miles of dikes.
If it just was, on the Mad River Slough.
Just on the Mad River Slough and North Arcata Bay. If it wasn't for FEMA coming up with that money, I don't know who would have ever repaired those dikes. Maybe they wouldn't.
Right.
And that's the thing that we're faced with, because every, you know, winter solstice, you know, around Christmas time or whatever, we have these extreme high tides we call king tides. And if that's also coincides with stormy weather and we have storm surge, there's areas around Arcata Bay that I went out on the January storm of, I think it was 2007, 2008, and the water was already going over the top of the levee, and I counted 18 different breaches.
Just this year?
Just in that year. And so, you know, we have dikes that are too low, and we have a lot of shoreline that's exposed that hasn't been maintained, and not much of the shoreline is actually fortified or armored. So we have a real need out there, you know, to know where are the problem areas so that we can focus our energy to assess what kind of engineering options would be available to repair and shore up those shorelines, develop the costs for that. Ultimately, you know, what it's going to lead to is that we're going to know where all the problem areas are. We'll do all the engineering to figure out what it takes to fix them, what it's going to take the cost to repair all of those shorelines. And somebody at some point has got to decide, is it in the public's good to invest public funds to repair these shorelines? Because much of the shoreline is dikes, about 53% of the shoreline.
Of Humboldt Bay.
Of Humboldt Bay. Let me back up. 75% of Humboldt Bay is artificial. Wow. It's just an artificial structure.
Right.
Structures like the dikes, which are about 49 miles of dikes, were built in many cases over 100 years ago.
Right.
And if they're not maintained, all the former tidelands or salt marsh that are behind the dikes that were drained and converted to agriculture, all those lands would be inundated if the existing shoreline structures fail, if they're not maintained. So we have thousands of acres of agricultural land at risk because it's already below sea level, and it's only because of the artificial dike. And when you look at 71% of the dikes aren't fortified, and there's 3.5 miles of dikes that are actively eroding right now. And so, you know, at some point, they spent $11 million in Arcata Bay and Mad River Slough. Some wonder if the agricultural land is worth $11 million that they put into it of public funds. So as a society, we're going to have to balance the cost and the energy and the commitment to maintaining existing shorelines, or do we allow shorelines to retreat? Those are kind of big question issues that this study is really just providing the basic information to assess where the problem is, what the magnitude of it is. But we are going to have to ask those hard questions.
So, you, Alderaan, as you're talking about this, you're saying this is not a theoretical problem. It's not something we're waiting for in the future. It's already happening. Maybe we should pull back out a little bit more and give people a sense of what the current scientific thinking is about the magnitude of sea level rise that we're facing, because I know that there's been significant developments on that front in just the last few years. What's the next 50 years, 100 years, 200 years look like in terms of the reasonable range that people are talking about?
The California Resource Agency has mandated all the state agencies to take into account in their development and funding and work that they're doing what would be the effect of 20 inches of sea level rise by 2050 and 55 inches of sea level rise by 2100 on any project that they would be funding or building or issuing a grant on. And so that's what they want you to look at. We're looking at 20 inches by 2050. The Coastal Commission, you know, which has a jurisdiction in the coastal zone, they have a little tougher standard. They want you to look at a minimum of 3 feet of sea level rise and a maximum of 6 feet of sea level rise. You know, that's quite a bit more than 55 inches in the coastal zone. And so those are kind of the numbers that are being kicked around currently, you know, in the planning circles and the work that I'm doing. But, you know, all of that is based on, you know, global or eustatic sea level rise, mostly just through thermal expansion. Nobody's looking at, you know, how much more sea level rise would be attributed to the melting of the Greenland ice cap or Antarctica. And, you know, and those kind of numbers, you know, kick it way up. You know, we're talking...
They're an order of magnitude larger.
Way higher,
than
you know. And if you go far enough out into the future, you know, look at a couple of centuries from now, I think they'll be looking back at, you know, we were just considering 20 inches by 2050. It's just, we're not used to 50 and 100-year planning horizons. We
right.
do general plans every 10 or 20 years, local coastal programs every 5 years if we can. So we're being forced into long-range planning in this exercise. And the other kind of 900-pound gorilla sitting in the corner of Humboldt Bay is the Cascadia subduction opportunity or event. And that would just re-wipe the slate clean, start everything over. We could drop as much as 3 feet in one event. And then all of a sudden, the sea level rise of 20 or 55 inches doesn't really seem very applicable anymore if we have that kind of a thing. So forgetting the Cascadia event, just looking at sea level rise, we already have a problem because we diked off 90% of the salt marsh, and that land is already lower than Humboldt Bay. And so it's only being able to use for agriculture or wildlife refuge purposes because the dikes are holding the salt water back twice a day. Every time
right.
the tide comes in and out. So and the problem is we don't have a Humboldt Bay dike district that's charged with managing the dikes around 102 miles of shoreline. It's left up to every individual property owner to maintain their dike. And I've seen instances out there on the bay where one property owner has armored his whole shoreline with concrete and rock, and it stops right at the property boundary. And the next parcel, it has a vertical bank of exposed dike that's eroding. If that one blows out, all the investment his neighbor put would be for naught. All his land's going to be flooded. We need to look at this in the sense of hydrologic units, not individual properties.
Not individual properties.
It has to be everybody in it together. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. And so the fact that we don't have a reclamation or a dike district for the whole bay is going to make it a lot tougher to plan.
So we're going to have to coordinate
very
not only
so.
These policy choices, but actually the individual actions across
mm-hmm.
that whole shoreline.
It's going to be a challenging couple of decades, because we really are going to have to address these actively eroding shorelines. And 71% of the artificial shoreline is not fortified. And, you know, the Reclamation District in Arcata Bay spent about $2 million a mile to rebuild theirs. City of Arcata redid their wastewater treatment ponds in the Arcata Marshes, and they spent upwards of $900,000 a mile. So, you know, we're looking at quite a few miles of shoreline. Who's going to come up with the money?
So just to summarize and recap, you're saying there's really three levels of issues you've identified in inventorying the potential impacts of sea level rise on Humboldt Bay. One is that our existing infrastructure has already removed a lot of the former shoreline and changed what was salt marsh into ag land or, in some cases, wildlife refuge. And we're at risk of losing those just from the existing action of tides. And
if the structure fails, you know, the shoreline of 1870 before it was diked is a long ways inland from the today's shoreline when you're walking on the dikes. In a lot of cases, it was up by Old Arcata Road, Bayside Road.
Right. And so the 101 corridor is just a spectacular example of what's at risk right there.
Yeah.
So two, we're talking about the impacts of rising seas, the sea level rise. And as you said, we are looking as a policy matter at the potential that's just the thermal expansion of seawater. We haven't even begun to address the potential for a significant rise in the overall amount of water in the sea if we lose the major ice caps on Greenland and Antarctica.
And, you know, Mike Furness pointed that out at the conference, is that for the last 6,000 years, we've been in a very stable sea level elevation, you know, around the globe. And prior to that, we had rapid rises of sea level. And so if we get to that tipping point where those ice fields, you know, start melting and contributing to the sea level, I think we'll see a rapid rise. That's what his research has shown, is that we've been in an anomaly for the last 6,000 years.
That really was a particularly striking slide that he presented, you know, a lot of really jagged peaks and then a real flat line for the last 6,000 years. But as you said, what we're hearing from the scientists in Greenland who are working on that ice cap is unparalleled amounts of melting, stuff that they don't even know how to characterize.
Right.
Everything's consistent with much more melting than we have been anticipating. So.
Exactly. And the third point was...
So the third point is then that we have the potential and indeed, in a way, the not just the probability, but the inevitability of a Cascadia subduction zone event here. Another presentation we heard at the symposium, as you mentioned, had to do with sorting out the complexities of how the landscape actually reacts in terms of rise and fall. There are places that will rise, places that will fall, but you're saying on the whole, we're likely to fall.
Well, you know, Tom Leroy showed some photographs of Japan, you know, with their recent event they had, and they dropped 3 feet, you know, in a matter of minutes. And he was showing some photographs of coastal areas that are permanently inundated now. They're brand new lagoons, a new big lagoon or freshwater lagoon that used to be a village or a town.
Or rice fields.
Or rice fields, you know, and that's what we face, a similar type of future, is that we're having local or regional uplift and subsidence. Crescent City seems to be rising as fast as eustatic sea level is going up, so there's no net effect. There's other areas that are actually subsiding, so the sea level rise is compounded. But then those are all kind of incremental processes that the Cascadia event would just reset and start the whole thing over again. It's just that resetting. I mean, with 75% of the shoreline artificial on Humboldt Bay, I doubt that much of that will survive a Cascadia-type shaking event, that all that shoreline would be gone.
So we would actually be destabilizing the dikes just by shaking them.
And particularly if it was high tide and it started shaking. I mean, Jesus.
Right.
These dikes were, you know, except for the ones maybe around the wastewater treatment pond, you know, in Arcata and Eureka, you know, they were never engineered. These were built by ranchers that were trying to convert salt marsh to agricultural lands. And so, you know, there's not a lot of engineering that's gone into them. And like I said, 71% of them aren't fortified. They're just exposed or vegetated. So there's some challenges out there to do that. And it was an interesting adventure, walking the shoreline, seeing all the different places, kayaking and walking everywhere. And I developed a list of attributes, you know, to describe the shoreline based on physical or biological things that I observed out there, whether they're made out of concrete or rock and rubble or dikes or bulkworks or things like that. And we also mapped where was salt marsh attached to the shoreline. One of the concerns is that if the salt marsh is all bordered by structures like dikes and we have sea level rise, there's no way for it to migrate in. It has to go up in elevation or it drowns. And so there has to be sufficient sediment coming in to allow the salt marsh to rise with the water levels. And that, I've read, probably can occur to maybe 2030, 2050, but then after that, the salt marsh would be overtaken by water and probably flooded out. And so we wanted to see where is there an opportunity physically for a shoreline to be allowed to migrate with sea level rise so we can maintain the whole host or series from tidal, intertidal, and riparian and upland habitats so that these don't disappear. I mean, we lost 90% of the salt marsh. We don't want to lose the last 10%. Right. You know, so we need to find those kind of zones, you know, that don't have infrastructure that would prevent the migration. But with so much of the shoreline being artificial structure, we're going to have to talk about acquiring property or maybe relocating dikes. And a lot of the shoreline is under public ownership now, you know, with Fish and Game, City of Arcata, Humble Bay National Wildlife Refuge. So they're looking at relocating their dikes and providing for future salt marshes and brackish water environments for coho and waterfowl.
You're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, director of the Friends of the Eel River. I'm talking with Alderon Laird, who's undertaken a comprehensive mapping and assessment project around Humboldt Bay, particularly to look at the potential impacts of sea level rise on the region. Alderon, another part of the story that Mike Furness presented at the Humboldt Bay Symposium was a slide projecting the potential inundation of the Eel River Delta. This is a local case of a larger story that Mike was telling, but we're looking there at a situation where a lot of what's now ag land could be underwater, as you said, very quickly in a subduction zone event or relatively quickly in a geologic sense. One question that raises for me is there a potential for some kind of silver lining in terms of recovering some of the habitat that was inadvertently lost in the ag conversions, in terms of habitat particularly for creatures like coho salmon, chinook salmon, that seem to really need more estuarine habitat than maybe they've got right now?
I think that there can be, like I said before, we've never undertaken 50 and 100 year planning horizons.
Right.
And if we look at a rising sea level in the Eel River Delta becoming slowly more saturated at higher groundwater table, a more frequent overbank flooding or just outright tidal inundation. As that estuary environment moves inland, because we're still going to have all of the runoff from the Eel River watershed coming down, meeting the sea, and it's mixing, we'll actually have an opportunity to replan the landscape, how we're using the landscape. 150 years ago, people built in the flattest areas there were because there's such a mountainous region. Those flat areas happen to be floodplains or flood-prone areas, and so many of those areas aren't suitable for cities and infrastructure. They're suitable for agriculture or wildlife refuge or streams and estuaries. So we may have to relocate some of our land uses if we can't get insurances to cover and underwrite these structures and buildings and communities. That in and of itself will cause them to relocate as they're frequently flooded. So.
Right. So you raise a really interesting problem there, which is that I understand that that's been an issue where the Congress may be preparing to take another look at the flood insurance system, which has underwritten a lot of development in low-lying areas, not only on coasts, but also along rivers. And that, I think, raises other questions about the policy implications of this kind of analysis and then the political implications of those policy questions.
The huge floods that we had on the Mississippi River in the last few years and the hurricanes on the East Coast going all the way up the East Coast. And every year we have hurricane season and hurricanes. And it's just that the cost of rebuilding these flood-prone areas is getting astronomical. And I think the insurance underwriters have started to question the value of allowing people to rebuild in those flood-prone areas. There's some people in Congress and in the communities at large that are just questioning, if you want to build on the seashore, if you want to build in a floodplain on on a river, maybe you need to take responsibility for the risks that you're exposing yourself to if you build there, and it shouldn't be underwritten by the public. You can imagine in Japan, I doubt they're going to let many people rebuild in that tsunami run-up zone anytime soon, not until they start losing the memory of that event. We don't have to wait for a Cascadia event to know where our tsunami run-up area is. We already have maps released on that, and I think that whenever we have an opportunity to relocate something or to prevent future development that would invest another 50 years of being in that situation, that we should take those opportunities. And we can't resist the sea forever. I mean, we can build a structure for a while, but ultimately the sea's going to win out. And so I just think that we need to have some smarter, more sustainable planning, and we need to give the river and the ocean the space it needs, and we need to occupy safer ground.
Those seem like fairly straightforward propositions you've laid out in terms of wise action. But in human society, it seems like we often run into some serious complications. And, you know, here one of the obvious ones is that the land that's next to the water is often worth more money, especially for development. And as we look at land uses now and in the next generation, over the next 20 years, 30 years, it's not unlikely that we're going to have some serious disputes over whether infrastructure ought to go in a place that's potentially subject to inundation.
We're starting to face those issues. I mean, sitting on the Planning Commission in Arcata for 10 years, every other Tuesday, you got to listen to people's dreams about their property and what they wanted to do. And oftentimes the harsh reality of what city government would allow them to do on their property was not what they were dreaming of it when they bought it. So I think that as the situations change, entities like the Coastal Commission are going to be hard-pressed to revisit some of their shoreline policies, in that they'll allow you to rebuild a structure like a dike, but you can't expand it. You can't make it any bigger. You can build it the way it was, but if it was built 150 years ago, it's obviously not adequate to address sea level rise going forward the next 50, 100 years. And so what's going to happen when a property owner wants to fix up his shoreline and he can't get the permits to do it? Is that a takings? And when we look at the whole region of Humboldt Bay and we have all these agricultural and wildlife uses of these former tidelands and stuff, do we want to give up all that seasonal freshwater wetland that's so valuable to waterfowl and wildlife? Do we want to eliminate some of the nicest agricultural lands that we have around the bay? It's not irrigated agriculture. This is stuff that's unirrigated. It's great for water conservation, and it's raising a great product that people want. And it's certainly, we've gotten used to that pastoral landscape. We're all vested in this landscape. And unfortunately, we're all going to have to ask the hard questions is that who's going to pay for the protection of these lands? Because we're going to have to do something. We can't not do anything. If we just let it unfold as it will, there's going to be an awful lot of breaches that we're going to experience all around. And the flooding will be haphazard. There won't be any planned response to this. So we really need to look at the whole unit and figure out, we know where the weak points are right now. We just need to get out there and do some engineering evaluation to figure out what the options are, what are the costs are. And then when we look at it by hydrologic unit, say all of the Eureka freshwater slough bottom land, and figure out what would it cost to protect that area? What's the value of the agriculture and the wildlife there? Then we can make an informed decision what to do there. It may be different down in Fields Landing or King Salmon. We're just now beginning this process with this baseline data as our foundation. We at least don't have to wonder what's out there. We know what's out there. We know the magnitude of the problem. Now we've got to figure out, there's always an engineering solution if you got the money.
Right.
And so,
but as you were pointing out, there are a lot of places where it just doesn't work for one property owner to address the problem one
work.
Piece at a time. You've got to have coordinated action or the water will find a way around.
I don't want to put them on the spot, but I guess I will. The Harbor District, their jurisdictional boundary is the shoreline. It's just, they're not formed as a dike district. They're a harbor and a bay district and recreational and conservation district. But the conservation of the shoreline and the habitats and the land uses associated with that shoreline, I could see them as being a coordinating lead agency, maybe creating an umbrella for the permitting, holding the permittings for all the repairs on the shoreline. I mean, we know the techniques that need to be done. And then depending on where the grant money comes from to do the repairs, that could be a way to do it.
Well, I really appreciate your coming on today, Alderaan, and the questions you raise are ones that we're going to have to address now, but the sooner we do, the better our kids will be in terms of the situation they're going to face.
Thanks for having this topic be your subject today.
Is there a good place for people to go who are concerned about these issues as your report online? And
when we do finish the report, I would imagine the State Coastal Conservancy will have it available online at their site. There is a California government site called CalAdapt, and you can go there, and they have lots of great visuals and graphics to show what temperature or sea level rises are going to be in various regions of California. But we'll publish the final report, make it available. The GIS database that we've created, the Coastal Conservancy wants to make that available to all the local and state agencies or federal agencies that want it, as well as interested stakeholders. So that'll be a freeware.
Great. Thanks so much, Aldron. Really appreciate it. So this has been the Eco News Report. My name's Scott Greeson. I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today was Aldron Laird. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, go to the public affairs page at khsu.org, and the programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air there. After that, you can go to the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. Files from the last year's show, at least, are up there. If you have questions or comments about this program, you can call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. And many thanks, as ever, to Fred McLaughlin for his indispensable engineering.